Good evening and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California, Buried in the Sky, the extraordinary story of the Sherpa climbers on K2's deadliest day with author Peter Zuckerman. My name is Cynthia Miashta. I'm the chair of the club's Asia Pacific Affairs Forum, and I'll be your program coordinator for tonight. Though Everest is the tallest mountain on Earth, K2, straddling the borders of China and Pakistan, is the most fearsome. Climbers call it the Savage Mountain. Before 2008, a total of 4,115 people had stood on Everest's summit. Only 278 had done the same on K2. Buried in the Sky follows one fateful climb and fully dramatizes both the allure and the menace of K2. But it also stands as a definitive book on the hidden world of the heroic, misunderstood climbers who are so often ignored in Western coverage of Himalayan mountaineering. When Edmund Hillary first conquered Mount Everest, Sherpa Tenzing Norgay was at his side. Indeed, for as long as Westerners have been climbing the Himalayas, Sherpa porters have been the anonymous experts in the background. Buried in the Sky travels to the home villages of several Sherpas, exploring their customs and culture, and following them to the slums of Kathmandu. In a region with few options for impoverished young men, the capital is the one place where they could find work and begin lucrative but dangerous climbing careers. The deadliest single disaster in K2's history occurred on August 1st and 2nd, 2008. Within 27 hours, 11 climbers had died. Many of them were among the best in the world. What went wrong is the answer Peter Zuckerman and co-author Amanda Padawan sought to answer in the course of their research. The death of one of Amanda's friends during climb was a catalyst for the book. Peter and Amanda are cousins who have written together since Peter was 12 years old. Before Buried in the Sky, Peter says he had a comfortable job as a daily newspaper reporter. He had never strapped on crampons. When we learned about this story, he says he had no choice but to quit his job, grab a notebook, and head to the Himalaya. Quote, "The characters were too inspiring, the goal too important, and the journey too compelling to resist." Peter Zuckerman has received some of the most prestigious recognitions in American journalism. At age 26, he won the Livingston Award, the largest all-media general reporting prize in America. Among the dozens of other awards his reporting has received is the National Journalism Award, given for the best newspaper writing in the United States, and the Blethin Award, given for the best journalism in the Northwest. PBS profiled Zuckerman in an hour-long documentary, In a Small Town, and Harvard University's Nieman Foundation for Excellence in Journalism profiled Zuckerman as part of a series about courageous reporting. Just in recent days, Buried in the Sky was awarded several awards, including the National Book Award for 2012, the largest award of its type, the George Orwell Award from the National Conference of English Teachers, and the Banff Mountain Book Award. Zuckerman has served as visiting faculty at the Poynter Institute, the St. Petersburg, Florida-based journalism organization, and he's taught journalism at universities and professional seminars. He's a resident of the Falcon Art Community and a teacher at the Attic Institute. Peter Zuckerman lives in Portland, Oregon. Would you please welcome Peter Zuckerman?
Can everyone hear me? All right. I just want to do a little survey here. Who here is a mountaineer? Oh, we got one. All right. And who here is... Oh, okay. All right. We got a few. Who here has been to Nepal? Oh, that's... And who here has worked with Sherpas before? Oh, there we go. Is there anyone here who identifies as a Sherpa? All right. So anyone here who feels like they know exactly what a Sherpa is? Good, because lots of people seem to think that and nobody seems to agree what it means. So I'm going to start talking about why this book matters, I think, to everybody and why Sherpas, why the why the story of the Sherpas is something that everyone can relate to. And I'm gonna tell you the journey that I had in writing this book. It started 3 years ago. My cousin Amanda, who I've been writing with and getting into trouble with since we were kids, she called me and she was just really upset. Her friend named Kareem had died on K2. Kareem was a high-altitude worker, similar to a Sherpa, and he'd really helped Amanda out on a previous climb. And so my cousin Amanda heard about his death and really wanted to know what happened to him and figure out if it was really him who had died. The reporting about the high-altitude workers was so vague that even though there was all this news about the disaster and all these stories about the Westerners who had climbed, there was really just sort of a side mention of some of the people who did some of the most dangerous and difficult work. So she called me and said, "Peter, you have to come with me. We have to figure out what happened. We'll write a book about it. We'll do the disaster on K2. We'll tell the Sherpa story. Are you in?" And I said, "No. I'm not a mountaineer, at least by K2 standards." Oh, I just hit a button. And I wasn't sure I wanted to spend the next 3 years trekking through remote villages in Nepal that were technically off limits to journalists. And I wasn't sure it would be safe to be a gay Jewish American trekking through Taliban-infested regions of northern Pakistan that the U.S. Embassy had warned me to stay away from because of the terrorist threat and basically told me, "You're on your own if anything happens." At that point, we didn't have a publisher. I'd have to quit my job, and I'd be risking my life to interview people who I honestly had no idea whether anybody would care about or interested in. Writing the book just sounded like a terrible idea. I said, "I've always loved adventure stories." So I told Amanda, "No, not going to do the book, but I'll do a little bit of research and try to find out some stuff for you." The 2008 tragedy on K2, which is between China and Pakistan and is not on the map right there. Maybe it is, but 11 people died in one day. And when I looked at the story, I could see immediately it was one of the most dramatic disasters in alpine history. It's, you know, life and death at the limit of human endurance. It's triumph and tragedy on a peak that's so lethal most people consider it suicide to climb. I didn't really see the Sherpa angle at that point, but I could tell it was a compelling story that, you know, people are broken by oxygen depletion and they have to make life and death decisions that are going to affect other people. And people were trapped inside the same tents and they're clashing with each other when their life depends on them getting along. And you think you know who the characters are. And then when things get really bad, it turns out that the person you thought was the good guy maybe wasn't. And the guy who was the bad guy was maybe the good guy. And the characters really captured me in that I feel like mountaineering stories, they make you ask yourself what you would do under similar circumstances. They make you question who you are. They make you say, you know, when things get bad, am I the sort of person that goes out there and tries to help out another person? Or am I somebody who hangs back? And when will I go and risk everything to save someone else? Would I do it for somebody who spoke a foreign language or who was poor and from a foreign country? Or would I only do it for somebody who was rich and famous? And it just makes you ask yourself what kind of person you are. But I felt like there are other books that have larger-than-life characters and how to tell this death-defying struggle up fixed ropes to a summit. And I didn't see the point of doing a book that was essentially a lot like other books. And so I said, okay, I'll look into the story of the Sherpas. And that's when I started looking into that, I saw that the Sherpas, especially when combined with the disaster on K2, they illustrate, the story illustrates a much more universal problem one we face nearly every day, all the time. And let me explain what I mean by that. Let me also get some water, one sec. So, on a mountain, Sherpas do some of the most difficult and dangerous work. They, depending on the expeditions, they scout the routes, they establish the routes, they carry up the gear, they establish the camps, they go back down and bring their clients to the summit, they take the photo of their client on the summit, they rescue their client when their client gets into trouble. And in a lot of cases, in some of the most famous adventure stories of all time, the Sherpas hold this, you know, sort of mysterious and mythical quality of being some, being these amazing people, but oftentimes their names aren't mentioned. Oftentimes it's like these fixed ropes just appeared and you hear about this death-defying struggle up them, but you don't know how did those ropes get there. And you hear about this terrifying wait for a rescue, but you don't really hear much about the person who did the actual rescue. And that got me thinking, you know, history, it's usually told about the kings and the Columbuses, not through the eyes of the help. And mountaineering and this disaster shows how that kind of omission can lead to people dying. That when your life hangs from a knot, you need to know who tied it. You need to know if it was tied correctly. When you're relying on a team to take you up a mountain, you need to know basic things about your teammates, like, do they speak the same language and can they communicate with each other? Are they business rivals? Are they ethnic rivals? Will they work together? Can they? And when you tell an incomplete story, when you tell a story that omits crucial perspectives, you fail to learn a lot, and what you fail to learn can have disastrous consequences. These were major issues in 2008 on K2, issues that contributed to death and disaster. And it made me think that for the rest of us, for those who aren't K2 mountaineers, we're actually largely in the same situation as the climbers are. We all hang from knots that other people have tied. We all have mountains to summit. We're all surrounded by people whom we don't notice. You think of, you know, the person who prepares your food at the restaurant or the last mechanic to check your plane before takeoff. But a lot of times, and in a lot of the stories, these people are very important. And the Sherpas of, it made me think, you know, the Sherpas of every story, they need to be seen for whom they really are. Our lives depend on that. And that made me feel like this is an important book to write, and this is an important story to tell, and something that everybody can relate to. So I'm going to start by telling you about the Sherpas. If you're not sure what a Sherpa is, don't feel bad. There's a lot of debate among the Sherpas about what a Sherpa is, because there's a lot of money at stake in what the answer is, and we'll talk about that more. But people come to Nepal, and they know they want to hire a Sherpa, and they want an authentic Sherpa. And even if they don't know what it means, if you can bill yourself in Nepal as a Sherpa, that means you can make a lot more money. And if your competitor, who you don't think is a Sherpa, can bill themselves as a Sherpa, you might really resent it because they're taking that business away from you. So mountaineers use the term Sherpa with a lowercase s, basically to describe any high-altitude load carrier. Commercially, it's used kind of like anything that helps people get around. You know, these are real products. You can get the Sherpa dog carrier to haul your terrier around in. You can brace your belly with the Sherpa maternity belt. You can store your diapers in the short-haul Sherpa diaper bag. And these are real products, and it kind of makes me wonder, you know, being Jewish, how I would feel if somebody said, oh, here's the Jewish diaper bag. And then a lot of people, and probably most people who are familiar with Sherpas, see them as an ethnic group, just like Hawaiian, Basque, or Greek are ethnic groups. And there's a lot to that ethnic group, and we'll talk about that more. But briefly, they're a very tiny ethnic group, if you call them an ethnic group. There are about 50 different ethnic groups in Nepal, depending on how you divide them. And the self-described Sherpas make up less than 1% of the population, and they're among the wealthiest people in Nepal. And the Sherpa name carries a lot of prestige, and it allows them, as we said, get a lot of money. So suffice it to say, Sherpas don't really mind the stereotype of them being cast as beasts of burden or things that help other people. It helps them get business. It promotes their skill, and it highlights their genetic advantage. And part of the reason Sherpas are famous are because they do so well at high altitude, and the genetic advantage they have is real. To talk about it from an evolutionary standpoint, the Sherpas who live near Everest descend from people of the Tibetan Plateau, and their ancestors have lived at high altitude for 11,000 years. That's long enough for evolution, for natural selection to take place. So compared to others studied, usually it's Caucasian men, but there are other ethnic groups that they're also compared to. Sherpas are more resistant to illness and brain damage caused by oxygen deprivation. They sleep more easily at high altitude, and they have tremendous endurance. Some people say, well, how does this work? What causes it? And the answer everyone gives is it's a high red blood cell count, and that's completely wrong. It's actually sort of the opposite. Compared to Caucasians and most other groups, Sherpas have fewer red blood cells per liter of blood than most groups. And the difference, they've looked into this, the difference isn't explained by diet or acclimatization or metabolism or iron deficiency or some other environmental factor. This has been studied exhaustively. And at sea level, Sherpas have such a low red blood cell count that they're technically anemic. They just don't show any symptoms. And they require, research shows their bodies need about as much oxygen as anyone else, and that they actually have less oxygen dissolved in their blood per liter. So scientists found this really confusing. I mean, red blood cells ferry oxygen around the body, and other populations that are well adapted to altitude have blood that's teeming with red blood cells. You look at the Andean highlanders, their red blood cell count is incredibly high. And so what explains it? And what seems to be the answer is that Sherpas probably circulate blood more quickly. They have very, very wide blood vessels. They breathe more often when at rest. And they exhale more nitric oxide, which suggests that their breathing is very, very efficient. And it seems that low red blood cell count is being selected for. There's this gene called hypoxia-inducible factor 2 alpha, which it's like a switch that turns on a lot of other genes. And there's evidence that makes a huge difference in whether they have that particular gene makes a huge difference over whether they have more kids. And then there's also another genetic trait, but it hasn't been identified, but seems to increase hemoglobin saturation, and that's inherited, which might mean that their red blood cells are more efficient, although the jury is still out on that one. And this is pure speculation, but it's possible that their thin blood helps stop blood clots, which are very common at high altitude. It can be fatal and kill a lot of people. But the truth is this is still being researched, and people are trying to understand how exactly this works. So the ancestors of the oldest Sherpa clans originated from Tibet. A lot of people find this a horrible thing to say because the Sherpas in Nepal do not currently like to identify a lot of times with people in Tibet. And then in the 13th century, the Mongols, who had their catapults and their horses, they drove the Sherpas out to central Tibet. And then in the 16th century, the Muslims from a place called Kashgar arrived. And the Sherpas, who they didn't call themselves Sherpas at that point, they called themselves Khampas. They fled on foot and migrated across the Himalaya to the area that's just near Everest. And this it's called Khumbu. And along the journey, they sometimes called themselves people from the east, or Sharwa. And then there were a whole bunch of more immigration waves that came over the mountains. And maybe some were caused by some people went over because of famine, maybe it was disease, maybe it was just good trading opportunities. There were just lots and lots of waves of immigration. And a lot of times these different groups settled separately into separate clans. And the villages that formed were really isolated. I mean, so isolated that the language in each village is largely considered its own language that's only spoken there, and they often differ. The languages between nearby villages often differ by about 30%. And different cultures evolved in each village, but there are also some things that seem to be the same across all the different villages. And one of the things I thought was really interesting was the naming system. It causes mass confusion in the cities. So traditionally, every Sherpa has one of seven names. It's the day of the week you were born, boy or girl. Everybody born on Monday is named Dawa. Everybody born on Tuesday is named Mi'kmaq. Wednesday it's Lakpa. And this goes all the way up to Sunday, which is Pemba. And then you think, okay, well, at least maybe they're last names. But no, they're not last names, really. When filling out legal forms, some Sherpas will write Sherpa as their last name, but really just last names aren't used. And this system of, you know, having seven names works more or less in a tightly knit village. But in the city, it's really a disaster and a challenge for a journalist trying to track somebody down. You can get the equivalent of a phone book, and you'll just find tens of thousands of people who are named Pasang Sherpa, which is Friday. And people will try to malign each other, and they have to provide elaborate descriptions of who they're trying to malign. And, you know, you'll be talking to people, and they'll say, oh, well, you need to talk to Friday, the one who's the son of Tuesday, who lives in this area, whose mother is Tuesday, and whose sister is also Tuesday. And it's really difficult to track people down. And making matters, you might think this would make things simpler, but making matters more confusing are the nicknames, because they change all the time, and they're often kept very secretive because names have a lot of power. And there are all these naming traditions. I'll give you some examples. So if a baby falls ill, the parents very frequently change his name to Cheering, which means long life. And the plan there is if you call your baby long life, it's going to confuse the evil spirits who are causing the baby to get ill. So that'll help them live longer. But then if the baby dies, then you need to change the name of the siblings. You need to change the name to something that's inconspicuous, something that the evil spirits won't notice. So usually, or in a lot of cases, the sibling's name will be changed to Kikuli, which is puppy, or something similar to that. And then, you know, if the baby's having trouble, or the kid is having trouble, the parents will often turn to a Buddhist Lama and say, hey, we need help here. And the Buddhist Lama, using divine inspiration, will figure out what the kid was in his previous life, or her previous life, and give that baby a name based on what their previous life was. So Tenzing Norgay, who's largely seen as the most famous Sherpa in the world, his original name was Namgyal Wangdi, which was actually a pretty unusual name. He was changed to Tenzing Norgay, which means wealthy follower of religion, because in his previous life he was a devout and religious man. And then there are the virtue names, which are often those of saints. You'll often hear Sherpas whose names are Lamu, which is the protector of temple gates. And then there's sometimes they're distinguishers, like if there's a whole lot of people in the family that have the same name, sometimes the youngest person will be called Aang before their current name, so it'll be like Young Tuesday, Young Wednesday. And then somebody who gives a really impressive speech, that person might be called Courageous Orator, or, you know, Lakpa Gyaljin. And then this is what is really difficult, is that the names change based on who you're talking to and where you are. And sometimes the spellings change based on the context. And so, you know, the main character in my book, Cheering, when he's talking to his religious leader, he goes by the name Dorje, which means, well, he and his parents have different reasons, have different claims of what the name means. But his parents say it's lightning bolt, and it was given to him because he'd lit a field on fire and I was supposed to protect him or something. And then when Cheering is in Tibet or talking to Tibetans or in a Tibetan context, he goes by Searing or Searing. So it's very difficult for journalists and writers, among others. And then Sherpas also tend to identify in roughly one of 20 clans, which reflect their ancestry. Children receive their father's clan name, but mothers keep theirs. And you're, in theory, not supposed to have sex with people who are in your clan or who are in your mother's clan three generations back. And clans have, there's sort of a tier of clans that, you know, just as you think of the names Kennedy or Carnegie or Rothschild or Rockefeller, they, you know, hold a certain amount of maybe prestige in the U.S. Well, it's the same with the Sherpas. So the Sherpas who are from the Lama clan are near the top, and they'll often say, we're the only real Sherpas, and everyone else is not a Sherpa. And, you know, then they're the people who are like the Botes. And by and large, the other groups say, no, Botes, which is... there's a long story about Botes, too. But in general, the Sherpas do not like the Botes, and the Botes call themselves Sherpas and say that Sherpa... well, we'll get into that. So what is a Sherpa? We're back to being confused here. And so the first wave of immigrants over the Himalaya, they called themselves either Sharwa or Sharkumbu, which means people from the east, and Westerners called them Sherpas, just kind of getting it wrong. And then in 1901, in the Darjeeling census, it classified Sherpas as one of four types of Botes, which the Sherpas now would find horrifying. And now Nepal says, oh, a Sherpa is just a self-reported ethnic group, and so anyone can claim to be a Sherpa. But the Sherpas from the oldest and wealthiest clan, they really don't like that. You know, just as colonial families who arrived on the Mayflower might feel like they have some special distinction, you know, the old clan Sherpas just say they're the only authentic members of their ethnic group in a lot of cases. And those who recently moved over, those people who descend from Tibetans, even though they also descend from Tibetans, those are not Sherpas. And then there are the people like Cheering, the main character of my book, and he's sort of an in-between. He's from a more recent clan, and he believes that members of his clan and a lot of other clans are Sherpas, and that a Sherpa is basically anybody who can convince the other Sherpas that he's a Sherpa or she's a Sherpa. You know, and you might do that by speaking one of the Sherpa languages, or you might do that by marrying a Sherpa person, or you might do that by adopting a Sherpa clan or being adopted into one. And then there are the Botes, who are on the other side of the spectrum, who one of my other major characters calls himself a Sherpa, but the Sherpas call him a Bote. And the Sherpas say that, and they just say Sherpa is a job description. And anyone can be a Sherpa. And look, Nepal agrees with me. That's what the government says. Which in Nepal is now using high altitude worker to describe the people who climb mountains. So, and then there are tourists who just add to the confusion, because a lot of times the tourists have hired a Sherpa, and that Sherpa has told the tourists their definition of the word Sherpa. And that, you know, either Sherpa is a job description, and the person that they've hired will give them a long explanation about Sherpa being a job description, and other tourists will be told, oh, Sherpa is an ethnic group. And they'll all argue with each other about it, and they'll all think they're right. And it happens with mountaineers too, and people get really passionate about it. And anthropologists argue about it too, because if they can attach the word Sherpa to their research, suddenly more people are interested in what they're researching. So there's all this, there's this sort of battle among the different Sherpa groups, but I'm going to say in general, there's also a fair amount of coexistence, and, you know, they worship the same gods, and they often intermarry, they often, you know, switch between villages that they're not really supposed to be part of, and they, you know, they climb on the same mountains in a lot of cases. And to sort of illustrate this duality, I was going to talk a little bit about the life of Tenzing Norgay, who was not a Sherpa when he was born, even though he's the person who made the Sherpas famous. So Tenzing was the first person with Hillary to stand on top of Everest. And Time magazine had him as, you know, one of the top 100 most influential people of all time. And he really led an incredible life. He was born in Tibet, and in the 1920s, his family they had a herd of yaks, and the yaks all got sick with probably there was a pandemic of Rinderpest disease. So that's probably what killed the yaks, and so Tenzing and his family moved to what's, you know, now Nepal at the foot of the Himalaya. And they moved there to be servants for the Sherpas, because the Sherpas were very rich from the mountaineering expeditions coming in. And so Tenzing was basically an indentured servant. He fell in love with a Sherpa woman, and the Sherpas really discriminated against him. He and the woman ran away. She died. He couldn't get a job in mountaineering because at the time the Sherpas were being very aggressive and stopping the Botes from getting jobs. They would all go on strike. They would demand preferential pay. They would just refuse to cooperate if Botes were hired. So the Sherpas became the best climbers, and they were the closest people in a lot of cases to the mountain. And Tenzing just couldn't get a job as a mountaineer, even though he really, really wanted to. And it was only until 1935 when this English climber named Eric Shipton needed to hire more climbers, and all the Sherpas were out on other expeditions. So he said, okay, we're going to open it up to some Botes. And that's how Tenzing got his first job. And he actually got it because it's this great quote in Shipton's journal. He said, he's talking about all these Sherpas who were lined up at the Planters Club in Darjeeling. And he says, there was one Tibetan lad of 19, a newcomer chosen largely because of his attractive grin. His name was Tenzing Norgay, or Tenzing Bhotia, as he was generally called. And the rest is his history, basically. Tenzing was, after that, was able to keep getting jobs, working as a Sherpa, or whatever you want to call it. And when he made it to the top of Everest, he identified as a Bote, but his team called him a Sherpa, and the media called him a Sherpa, and all the Sherpas were like, yes, he's a Sherpa, because now he's really famous. And he said, yeah, I'm a Sherpa. And he then settled into a Sherpa village. He married a Sherpa woman. And, I mean, he definitely, by the end of his life, was definitely a Sherpa. But to a large extent, the Botes very much resent it and say, you know, if Tenzing had said, I'm a Bote, the Botes would be the celebrity ethnicity that everybody wants to hire. So I'm gonna show some slides that tells a little bit about the book and shows you who some of these people are. So this is just the general area where the Sherpas live in Nepal. And this is a chorten, which is sort of it's a marker that the Sherpas have in their villages. A lot of times they're designed to keep away bad spirits. And this is our main character, Cheering. And he's the one on the right, on your right. And here he is again at age 14. That's when he started working as a high-altitude porter on Everest, which Everest is training ground for most Sherpas, because it's actually a relatively easy mountain to climb if you're in good shape. It's not very technically difficult. And this is K2, which is actually a mountain in Pakistan, but the Sherpas from Nepal are imported to help climb. And K2 is largely considered the most dangerous and difficult mountain in the world. And that's where K2 is. You can see it. And this right here is the climbers going up the bottleneck of K2. And Cheering, the main character, pulls off the most amazing rescue in maybe the history of K2, sort of near this area. And to understand this photo, you have to realize it's taken vertically, so that the ice on top is like a balcony. It's coming over the climbers. And so what happens in a really short version is the climbers run out of rope. They get to the top of the mountain really late in the day. Everything starts to fall apart as they're freezing, and a huge chunk of ice breaks off, maybe a chunk of ice, maybe the size of this building, and it shears off all the ropes. So the climbers are stuck, and they have to decide, oh, do I try wandering down? Well, the ones who were clear enough to think and who knew what was going on, they had to decide, oh, well, do I risk freezing to death on the top of a mountain? Or do I risk going down the bottleneck, the most dangerous stretch of the most dangerous mountain? And so Cheering decides he's going to go down the bottleneck. And he's making his way down, and he encounters another climber, Pasong, who's a Bote, who's from a different team, who Cheering has no reason to help out. And Pasong has lost his ice axe. An ice axe is a really crucial piece of equipment. It's basically what you use to grab onto the ice. You hack it into the ice to hold yourself. And Pasong has lost his ice axe. He's on the bottleneck. Huge blocks of ice are shearing off the mountain because as the ice freezes, it expands, and that causes the cracks to widen, and that causes the glacier to push off and for ice to fall. And Pasong is there, and everybody else has passed Pasong because rescuing him is suicide. I mean, you just can't save somebody who doesn't have an ice axe on the bottleneck of K2. And Cheering grabs a piece of rope, a rope that's, you know, maybe about an arm's length long, and he ties it onto Pasong, and the idea is that Pasong will basically dangle off Cheering below him, and Chering will just go down the mountain with this guy dangling off him. And they fall several times. There are several cases where they have to dodge really big blocks of ice. But they actually make it. And nobody at this point had ever heard of a rescue like this. In fact, Chering just won the Tenzing Norgay Award from the Explorers Club in New York, which is like the really prestigious adventure award for this rescue. So that happened kind of near the top of this, where it's actually a little bit more steep. These are just Tibetan mountaineers who are roped up in the snow. This is courtesy of the Royal Geographical Society. There was a man named Dr. Kellis whose work at the turn of the century brought the Sherpas to light and started training them. So this is from about 1907. Here they are on a peak in Sikkim. And here, I'm not quite sure where this is. This is just on a high pass. Here's the 1921 Everest expedition. They're going up. And this is the 1922 British expedition where the Sherpas, their thumbprints are taken the thumbprints of their relatives are taken so that if a Sherpa dies, which happens frequently, their relatives can collect the money from their pay. And then there were all these strange tests that were done to determine if the Sherpas were fit to, and it's still sort of done this way, to determine who's fit to climb, because the Westerners are trying to decide who knows anything about climbing, and everyone says they're a climbing expert. So they're given vaccinations, but in a lot of cases there used to be the smell test that was done and this taste test of the Sherpas, and this they'd have to do all these various exercises. And that actually still kind of happens, but not to the same extent because there are some certification organizations. And then they're issued identity coins so the Westerners can figure out who they are. This is on the North Col of Everest. This is provisions for the British expedition of 1922 in Tinki, which I've not quite figured out where that is. That's about 350 yak loads and 50 porter loads. And then this is Tenzing Norgay, the man who made Sherpas famous. And Tenzing, here he is when he was hired on his first, when he was hired in one of his first Everest expeditions with, this is actually the first expedition with Eric Shipton, where he was chosen because of his smile. Here they are on the northern. This is more of the expedition with Eric Shipton. This is a short answer. Here he is. Here's Tenzing on the seventh Everest expedition. He's pictured with his mother, Kinzom, and it's actually right before the expedition at a monastery. Tenzing was also, he was a full member of the British expedition, which was the first time an indigenous climber had been afforded that status. And he also served as a sirdar for high altitude workers. And here he's shown organized. The sirdar means he's like the head honcho of the high altitude workers. And here he's shown organizing the payment of the porters with Colonel John Hunt, who was also the big head honcho of the expedition. Here they're carrying loads to Everest in 1953, strapping on crampons, which they look a lot different than modern crampons. Just carrying loads across an ice fall. This is how it looked back then. Um, This is a rope ladder. These are from the 1953 expedition, which was when Tenzing made it to the summit. And here he is on the summit of K2. And I think I'll probably end with this so I can answer some questions. But what I like about this photo is I feel like it captures the plight of the Sherpas, where here's this guy. He was photographed because he didn't know how to operate a camera, so Hillary had to take the photo of Tenzing. And you can't see who he is. He's just some guy. And he kind of remained that way, somebody few people knew about. And I think in closing of this talk, I want to say that working on this project, it really changed me. It made me think that, you know, I was going to villages where people like Tenzing lived and where people like Cheering and Pasang, the major characters of the book, lived. And on the one hand, I felt like, gosh, it's so nice here. They everybody knows each other. Everybody really seems to care about each other. You know, there's not this sense of isolation that we have, and there's not this feel of being in the rat race all the time. And that I thought was really pretty amazing. But then on the other hand, I felt like, gosh, here are people who are subsistence farmers who live off of, you know, in a lot of cases, no money. You know, they're often described as living off of less than $1 a year, but the truth is it's just not a money economy. And it made me think, you know, I just went to a coffee shop and, you know, not too long ago and bought a cup of coffee that costs more than a lot of these people will see in their entire life. And that money could have been used to actually buy antibiotics that would be saving people's lives. And I feel like I'm so lucky to not live in a place where I'm, you know, that to know that I'm probably not going to die of an infectious disease. And, you know, I have all these great comforts like electricity and running water and petroleum and in some places machinery. And so throughout writing this book, I felt this great responsibility to the characters. Most of them lost family members. And in a way, this is just a horrifying story. But in a way, it's also a really inspiring story. You know, Sherpas, in a lot of cases, start out at very small villages, incredibly remote villages, and they end up as some of the richest people in Nepal, and some of the best athletes in the world, pulling off, you know, courageous feats that seem unimaginable. And so I want to say I'm grateful to my friends who have allowed me to see the top of the world through their eyes. You know, without their willingness to help see things from their perspectives, this book would have been impossible. And my hope is that the story of the Sherpas does more than, you know, just inspire you and inform you about a different culture. And my hope is that Amanda and I can make a small contribution to the way that we actually tell stories, and that the stories give you a glimpse into your own life and help you recognize and more deeply appreciate the Sherpas who are all around you. So thank you very much.
I don't know if I've read this correctly, but I seem to recall a statement that Sherpas who guide Westerners to the mountain actually have a moral dilemma, that there's some sense of violation of the nature and sanctity of the mountains. Have I got that right? And can you speak to that?
You are absolutely right. So Cheering, the main character of my... So the Sherpas believe that the mountain, that gods live in the mountains. And going up a mountain is sacrilegious. In the early expeditions, a lot of Sherpas would not do it because it was just seen as too offensive to the gods. In Cheering, the major character of my book, got in huge trouble with his family for climbing mountains. They're really offended that he continues to do it, and his wife, you know, threatens to leave him over it. Just because it's seen as such an assault on the gods. But the standards are kind of changing, especially on Everest. Everest is the mountain of wealth and prosperity. And so the thought is, well, Everest isn't killing that many Sherpas, and it's making a lot of Sherpas rich. So there's sort of this Everest exception now to the climbing mountains, and that if you get rich climbing Everest, that's okay, but, you know, the other mountains are off limits. But yeah, absolutely. It's a lot of Sherpas consider it blasphemous to be climbing mountains.
Is there something that you find inherent in their value system that makes them take on the risk of these rescues, even when their clients are irresponsible?
Yes and no. The very religious Sherpas who are really afraid of the mountain gods, and let me tell you, writing about Sherpas can be a real challenge because they often explain what happened in terms of omens and mountain gods and dragons that attacked them, and, you know, they're in a lot of cases hallucinating, so it's hard to even say, you know, what's true and what's not up on a mountain. They're on their best behavior on a mountain because the goddess is right there and she's watching your every move, and you're already doing something that's wrong. So if you need to offset that by just being incredibly generous in taking that extra step. And so, yeah, that part of their value system, I think, is, I mean, when Chiang talks about why he rescued Pasong, that's what he talks about is this concept of Sanam, which is, there's a lot to it, but, you know, sort of, what, I have to be on my best behavior and pass it forward.
I have not read the book yet, but I'm curious to find out, amidst all the many things you learned and the many directions in which it probably took you, you know, starting with one idea and moving forward and changing it, was your cousin able to get her question answered about what happened to her friend, and were those things resolved as a result of your research and the whole thing?
They were resolved. Her friend did die on the mountain. He spent the night up on top, you know, really, really cold. It looks, and wandered off, and was all alone, but we can see him in photos. And then later in the day, we can see that he kind of slid down the mountain. There's a trail suggesting, showing that he slid. And then there's sort of debate about what happened next. There's something that looks like a path in the mountains, which suggests that maybe he somehow got up and kept trekking. But it's really hard to tell from the photos, and there really aren't many good witnesses. Because the people who he might have joined, everybody was buried in an avalanche. So Amanda, when she found out he'd really died, she was really upset. It was, he'd really, you know, helped her out on a mountain, and she was all, you know, there were times where we were doing the research and we were thinking, oh, maybe it's somebody else, and then no, it was him.
Oh, I'm just wondering about your next project.
I'm looking at a story out of Malawi in Africa about a man and a transgender woman who get married, are sentenced to prison for getting married, are basically sentenced to the equivalent of death. But Madonna happens to be there adopting a child, and she makes it a big cause celeb, and Hillary Clinton gets involved, and the UN changes how it doles out foreign aid, and I'm just wondering what happened to this couple, and what is it like to you know, fall in love somewhere where you're killed for it in some cases. So that might be the next book, but we'll see. Well, thank you very much. And I guess you go now.
Okay. Thank you very much, Peter Zuckerman.
Thank you.